BCFM 93.2.
Diana asked her lawyer, told him that she had from a very confidential source in the palace, Prince Philip, to get rid of her in a car accident.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As the world's superpowers shape up for confrontation in the Middle East, one of China's biggest explosives factories blows up. Is it an accident or sabotage? Or could it even be a response to China's yuan devaluations, which many see as being the latest shots of an international currency war, to add to the media wars and cyber wars already raging? And Ukraine and Poland, are they becoming NATO's far-right, hard eastern edge as rumours circulate of NATO nuclear weapons moving east? Plus, one of the biggest conspiracy theories the world's ever known is that bin Laden in his cave in Afghanistan was behind 9/11. But were the Israeli Secret Service actually behind the 9/11 attacks? And if so, is it anti-Semitic to say so? So as the 14th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks creeps up on us, we hear from one of the only journalists in the world who believes he can pin the blame, and he, like me, he's regularly smeared as an anti-Semite. But what do you do when so much of the evidence points to the Israeli Secret Service being one of the prime movers behind the attack on America back in 2001? We hear new evidence tonight from old Bilderberg exposing colleague of mine, the author of Solving 9/11, Christopher Bolin. That's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the hotspots. We're also joined in about 15, 20 minutes by David Powell from Friends of the Earth. But first, I'm joined on the line by Bill Woodhouse. He's a retired Royal Navy sub-lieutenant who got to know Ted Heath through his boat-building firm. Hi there, Bill, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Yes.
So tell us, first of all, really, how you first met Ted Heath.
Well, I met him through sailing, very early days for Ted Heath sailing. A great aunt had left me a small legacy, just enough to do what I'd always wanted to do, which to commission my own racing dinghy. And it was due to be finished just before the London Boat Show. And in fact, I dithered whether to have 10 days exposed to all the dust and everything. But in the end, I decided that Jack Chippendale, who was the builder, would probably make an even better job than he usually did. He always made a wonderful job. And it also is interesting because the first time dinghies were the bottom floor of Earl's Court, not up on the mezzanine, and they were able to have their sails up. And I had commissioned Banks to make my sails. And when he heard they were getting Bonchot at the Earl's Court Boat Show, he made three suits of sails, for he's happy with them, so perhaps I made the right choice. Anyway, I at that time was running Aston Martin to go on to the service depot, and I couldn't get down to see my lovely new boat until a Saturday afternoon. And I arrived, and a friend spotted me and said, "Tell that man there behind the sail to take his sticky paws off your lovely new varnish." So I walked round the stern of the boat, and there was Ted Heath. And he was talking to Jack Chippendale, asking all sorts of questions. Why was this there? Why was that there? And Jack Chippendale was delighted to see me, because he didn't know quite some of the fittings I'd specified. And so we had a long chat, and he was quite knowledgeable. At the time, he was sailing snipes or broadstairs with a rather nice young man, possibly a boyfriend, I'm not sure about that. And we chatted for a long time, and then Peter Bateman wandered up. He was the current world champion. And so I introduced him to Ted Heath, and I said, "Ted, this is Peter Bateman, current world champion." And I was dropped like a hot brick. The arm went round Peter Bateman, and he said, "Right, let's go and have a beer at the bar, and we talk tactics," which was quite funny. But we kept in touch, and when I eventually became chairman of the Fireball Association, we had European Championships at Hailing Island. and I asked Ted if he'd come down and give the prizes away at the end of the championships, which was very good of him in a way, because it meant missing the last day of Wimbledon. But he came down, and I was out on the water assistant race officer, and when I came ashore, I rushed up to the bar to greet Ted, because someone had said he'd arrived, and he was at the bar looking like a stuffed dummy. He was absolutely motionless, no expression on his face at all, holding half a pint of beer, and Terry Lees of Dunhill was in, trying to entertain him. Dunhill were lending us a lovely boat for starting boat, and my association secretary was also trying to keep him happy. And I wandered up and I was introduced, and so I got a sort of little bit of a smile. And I thought, well, I've got to find something to interest him. So I said, Morning Cloud the Third at your building, why have you gone away from wheel steering and gone back to a rudder? And that woke him up. He then became quite lively. But having had a little chat about Morning Cloud the Third was under build, he then went back to being his sort of stuffed dummy again. And then the wives came up and were introduced, and he sort of a glazed look as they all went past, and sort of a little handshake. And I said, oh, that's my wife, Ted. So she got a second look. I definitely got the impression he did not like women very much. As I say, we kept in touch, and I got to know him reasonably well, but undoubtedly he was a very strange man.
What about his days at Balliol College? Because I understand that there was rumours, anyway, of some kind of scandal cover-up there.
Well, yes, there were all sorts of rumours, and some of them, I think there's got to be grounds for some of them, because when he was at Balliol, Oxford, he apparently got found out doing something rather indiscreet. I think it was possibly a boyfriend found out by the proctors, and apparently the story goes that the German DVD found out about this, and he was really being blackmailed by them for the rest of his life. I think the boyfriend he had at Balliol, he went through Germany in 1939 on a camping holiday.
Well, hang on a minute, because that's, I think you're referring there to Madron Seligman, because this is after the scandal at Balliol. He then went off camping, which is, it's almost unbelievable to think that just at the time of the outbreak of the Second World War, Ted would go off camping in Nazi Germany.
Well, indeed, quite apart from which, the Nazis were not very keen on two young men sharing a tent anyway. But they obviously turned a blind eye there. And right up, must have been August, when the Germans were building up, ready to invade over the frontier, the frontier was practically closed to everybody, but he and Seligman were allowed through to go to Warsaw. Now, what on earth they were doing in Warsaw, one does not know, but it was very strange. And then they were allowed back again. And they must have seen all this build-up of tanks and God knows what.
Hang on a second there, Bill, because when you say they were allowed back, do you mean they were allowed back into Nazi Germany after being in Warsaw?
Indeed, they were. They were, having been to Warsaw. I mean, that's the absolute fact. And, you know, it does raise questions. What on earth was going on? And then when war broke out, He enlisted, of course, like everybody else, and his first appointment was to an anti-aircraft regiment up at Liverpool. And there were stories that the Germans were aware of all the convoy movements in and out of Liverpool. So again, the finger rather points to perhaps Edward being blackmailed by the DVD. Very strange indeed.
But when you got to know him socially, I mean, you've said he would sort of be quite sort of motionless and that kind of thing. How was he socially?
Well, extraordinary. As I say, he was like a dead lamp bulb. And if you found something interesting in him, he'd, like a switch, he'd turn it on and come alight. When you gave the prizes away at the end of the European Championships, having been this sort of stuffed dummy at the bar, he came into the room and he lit up and he was absolutely brilliant. He charmed all these Norwegians, French, Spanish, Danish sailors, all fairly young men, said how wonderful they were. He wished that he could have them crewing in Morning Cloud, and they all loved it. So, I mean, he could just turn it on, but when he wasn't interested, he went completely blank.
Was he a sailor, Bill?
Hmm?
Was he a sailor? Because I know he became very famous for his Morning Cloud and all that. Was he actually a sailor himself?
That he ordered. He was ordering it, actually, while I was with him at the London Boat Show. And he got it delivered that summer. And he simply could not manage it. He spent his whole time capsizing. And because he was then a very senior politician, of course, he had a security guards, two of them, who used to follow in a motorboat. And he capsized so often that they eventually said, "Sir, you've got to give this up, because one day we won't get to you before you drown yourself." And that's when he took up big boats. The question really is, how on earth did the son of a fairly small builder in Broadstairs ever find the money? I mean, he got obviously parliamentary salary, but that wasn't that much money to build an ocean racer, which was certainly an expensive game. But somehow he did. And I got to know, because most of the people who sailed with him were recruited from Pearl Harbor, and I was at Parks and Rec Club, nearly all the people who sailed with him. And I think he was probably a very good tactician, but he was an absolutely useless helmsman. They would never let him touch the helm from the before the start of the race until the race was over. And then they let him take the helm for publicity photographs. But I think he was a very good organizer, and in some ways, obviously, a very capable man, but he was a hopeless sailor. Hands-on sailor, that is.
Now, what about rumours that he was actually being paid by the Chinese? I think something like £200,000 a year. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
He went to China, as I think we all know, and was given a panda. And from then on, he was paid $212,000 a year. $212,000, quite a lot of money, to be the Chinese PR man. Well, for sake of argument, PR, public relations. $212,000 a year until the day he died.
What are your thoughts about the press reports over the last couple of weeks then about him being investigated for child sexual abuse? You obviously don't know the details, but what are your thoughts about those that have emerged and how that affects what we now know about who was the man who was Prime Minister in the 1960s and 1974, particularly 1974 when we entered the European Union?
Well, indeed, and again, one wonders what pressures he was under to do that. Did he really believe in it? I had quite a lot of correspondence with him after that. And in one letter he wrote to me, he said, "Some people are calling me a traitor. Now, how can I be a traitor? My war record." And I rather cheekily wrote back and said, "Well, of course, Peter had a wonderful First World War record, the siege of Verdun, and so on. And look what he did when the Germans invaded in 1940. He collaborated with them." And he wrote back and said, "Don't you dare compare me with Peter," which was all I found rather interesting. I didn't know him that well, but I definitely got the impression he did not like women. I think there was one woman he did quite like who was married to a good friend of his. So he was definitely a very odd character.
And what about, was some kind of boating, I think it was an Olympic champion, that he managed to get him so that he wasn't given an award of some sort? I think it was either MBE or OBE or something like that too.
Oh, well, yes, that's another thing, because I have a very good friend in Rodney Patterson who won gold 3 times and a silver in the Flying Dutchman, and probably would have won a 4th gold if we hadn't pulled out of the Italian races. The government pulled out of the Italian races when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. And anyway, when Rodney won his another gold at Kiel in the Flying Dutchman, on the last day, they had to be on the water for two races back-to-back because weather had meant they missed a race, and to make the series they had to have these two races. So they had a very long day and came in very tired and rather without any grub. I think they had a few Kit Kats and things with them. And in those days, the Kiel Yacht Club was still run by the Royal Navy. So they went, changed, had a shower, came up to the wardroom, and they were given the typical naval strong gin and tonic. And Rodney's crew, it rather went to his head. He got just a tiny bit tipsy, which is not surprising. I mean, an almost empty tummy. And Edward Heath arrived completely unexpectedly. He effectively gate-crashed the prize-giving. And he was introduced, of course, to everybody. And Rodney introduced, because Rodney knew Ted quite well, introduced his crew to him. And his crew said, "Hello, Teddy. Fancy seeing you here." And Edward took the most appalling umbrage at this. He didn't like to be addressed like that. And he wrote to whoever it was to say, "This man is not to be given an MBE," which was very odd because Harold Wilson had decreed that all crews of winning boats would be given an MBE, both the helmsman and the crew, or however many there were. And this is the only man who was never given an MBE. Now, Rodney's been trying for years to right that wrong without success. Most extraordinary.
What about the child abuse scandal more generally? Because this is almost a very, very serious problem racking the nation, Bill. Is there any thoughts that you've got about what needs to be done? Because it's quite clear that certain very, very powerful people have been involved in this and are still covering it up to this day.
Well, that is very true. Very true indeed. If anything did go on, it was probably when he had his flat at the Albany. But I wouldn't think it was children. I really wouldn't. But he did, I think, have a bit of an aptitude for pretty boys.
What about more generally in the country, though? What needs to be done about this scandal? Because it seems to be dragging on and on, Bill, with no resolution, and the powerful are just protecting themselves.
Well, yes. Is it worth police time having a witch hunt on things that have happened? But, of course, I mean, it was terrible. I mean, Jimmy Savile, we know. But a lot of people did know at the time. And there's no doubt that Dolphin Square, which I stayed there once or twice with a girlfriend whose father had a flat there, and there's no doubt that some pretty odd things went on in Dolphin Square. But from what I know of Edward Heath, I don't think he would have molested children. But as I say, I wouldn't say he didn't have a few little boyfriends.
I know you're a member of the UK Independence Party. What are your thoughts, Bill, about what needs to happen with modern Britain, and what's been the effect of joining the European Union? Actually, it was Ted Heath that took us into the EEC, wasn't it?
It was indeed. It was indeed. And what's more, what is so bad about that? He said he would not do so without the full support of Parliament and the full support of the people. Well, the people were never consulted, and Parliament was so against it that the two stages were voted against the ECA 72, the European Communities Act of 1972. It was rejected twice. And in the end, Ted made it a vote of confidence in his government. Well, now, that is really putting MPs on the spot, because if they vote against it, the government's going to fall. And by that, he won by 9 votes. So we were taken in to the European Economic Community, then was, which is quite different from what the EU is now, on 9 votes, on a vote of confidence in the government. I mean, I think that, frankly, is utterly disgraceful. But at the time, I was actually rather for it, because I was selling an awful lot of watches to places like Sweden, who were EFTA, and they were a pain in the neck. You had to have all these customs forms and take them to the nearest Chamber of Commerce, waste half a day doing it, and get them stamped. And so when we had the referendum 75, I'm ashamed to say I voted for it, because I thought that the EEC, the European Economic Community, the common market, we were told it was, no loss of sovereignty. Now that brings me to another thing, no loss of sovereignty. Edward was sent a letter by his Attorney General, which laid out in great detail the enormous loss of sovereignty that would be involved with EEC 72. He was in his office when the letter was delivered, and Thornycroft was the only man with him in his private office. And Ted opened the letter, read it, and went as white as a sheet, and then folded it up, put it in his pocket, and said to Thornycroft, "No one must know about this, not even the cabinet." It was disgraceful the way we were taking into the EEC. And then, of course, at Maastricht, when it became quite obvious it wasn't going to the common market anymore, it was going to be the European Union, we should have had a referendum then. I think we've been treated disgracefully by our politicians over this issue. And, of course, it doesn't have anything much to do with Teddy's sexual predications, but... he was quite capable of obscuring facts and telling downright lies that there'd be no loss of sovereignty. He knew perfectly well we would lose enormous sovereignty. Well, we'd lose control of our country. Our laws are not made by elected politicians anymore. They are made by unelected, self-appointed apparatchiks. Most people don't even know who they are. And they're not discussed, they're all made in secret. They're then presented to the European Parliament, who have to rubber stamp them. Nowadays it has changed. If they don't like a law, they can send it back. And if it's presented a week later, they have to pass it.
Well, Bill Woodhouse, fascinating talking to you from down in Dorsetshire, I think, aren't you?
Yes, I am, right in the middle. Lovely part of the world.
Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show tonight.
Well, Tony, have I answered your questions?
You certainly have, thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Okay, bye then.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And I'm joined in the studio now by David Powell from Southwest Friends of the Earth, but actually National Friends of the Earth, working down here in the Southwest. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Evening, Tony.
First of all, let's just start by looking at the international situation, and maybe you and Martin, you can come in as well on this whole situation with what's been going on with the Chinese economy, because obviously these sorts of things massively affect things like energy prices and what's happening globally. Martin, what's your take on the Chinese devaluation, because they've done it several times now? Some people are talking about this as a currency war.
Well, I think what was surprising was they said they devalued the yuan earlier in the week, and they said it was a one-off adjustment, and then they came back the next day to adjust it again, which tends to suggest panic, doesn't it?
So what does devaluation mean for Western markets, for us?
Well, in general, what devaluation does is what we're in danger of having now, and I'm sure David will have something to say about this, is everybody's trying to get their currency lower, because that means that their exports are cheaper. So in other words, the Chinese are trying to get their exports cheaper, but that means in fact that they're squeezing other countries out of those export markets, not least their neighbours like South Korea and so on. So if everybody starts doing this is what happened in the 1930s, and exchange rates were fixed in the 1930s in a way that they're not now, apart from the Chinese currency. And, you know, we could end up with a currency war. That is to say, everybody's trying to make their currency cheaper, but everybody can't do that. And it basically exports deflation around the world.
Yeah, and the Chinese, I'd understood that the Chinese were trying to stop being so export-focused. It's actually one of the things they were trying to do, was to get their economy off being hugely reliant on exporting. Because if you do that and the global economy tanks, suddenly your economy's in a big spot of bother. So it is clearly about exports. But, I mean, the other thing going on, Tony, that's really interesting is about oil and about the price of oil, which is refusing to rise. And you would think, from the fact the oil price is low and is staying low, and $50 a barrel seems to be the new normal, normal. You would think people would be stopping pumping, but they're not. I mean, so you've got, obviously in Iran, you've got a huge amount of untapped oil about to enter the market. The Saudis are showing no sign of reining it in. The US are showing no sign of reining it in. And Martin just talked about, you know, a race to the bottom. What's going on with oil is terrifying. Everyone is continuing to pump, despite the fact that not everybody is going to make money out of it. And there's a huge amount of oil in the global market. Plus, you've got Shell going into the Arctic this week. Plus, you've got fracking taking off who knows where. So it's really quite scary. There's a bubble in there somewhere, I tell you.
Okay, so the I am slightly cynical. And when I saw the price of fuel going down over the last couple of weeks, I thought, oh, this is cheap ISIS oil. Is that because they are selling oil onto the international market?
Not enough to make a difference to the petrol pump here in Britain.
It's not just them. But I mean, how are we in this situation? I'll put this one to you, Martin, where oil tankers full of ISIS oil are chugging around and they're not being commandeered or whatever by US naval vessels, this kind of thing.
Well, the ISIS, we were talking about this earlier, ISIS are basically being supported from outside Syria by various political forces, not least the Turks and the Saudis. But I think the point, let's pick up the oil. The Saudis agreed with the Americans to reduce the oil prices as a means of punishing the Russians. That's, I think, pretty much what's been going on. But the Russians and the Saudis have now been chatting because it's actually the Saudis are hurting. Mm. I think the problem is that what people are locked in, it's like the fishing industry. Once you've invested in massive factory ships, you can't. You then spend all that money on them, so you've got to try and get some money back. So, you know, it's no longer viable, but what you do is you just suck up all the fish so that you can get some of the money back that you've invested in these ships. And I think the same is true in the fracking industry in the US. They've committed to getting this stuff out of the ground. They've spent the money, and if they don't then sell some oil, they're not going to get any of the money back. And I think this is what happens in depressions and deflations, is people don't just get out of the market and you get an orderly reduction of production. Everybody just goes hell for leather to get anything back on what they've already committed themselves to do.
Yeah, and the other part of this that's quite interesting is when you look at climate change and you look at, you know, we can only burn so much of this oil anyway. And I campaign to do stuff about climate change, and everyone thinks doing something about climate change is very important. Sometimes you forget that oil is, as you've just said, the number one geopolitical weapon that is generally used. It is phenomenally important to the way this entire world works, economically, politically, socially. And one of two things is going to happen. So if we're going to do something about climate change, all of these assets that are pumping out oil, all of these rigs, all of this fracking that's going on, can't pump. Right, so if that stops, then the price collapses. Or if we just go and pump it all anyway, then there's far too much as well, so the price collapses there too. Either way, there's a massive bubble coming here. It's quite scary economically,
but it's surely it's good environmentally.
Which bit of it?
Well, it's if there's less oil being used.
But there isn't less oil being used.
No,
well,
it's just the price going down.
The price is going down, which means it's cheaper, which means people are using more of it. The impact that you might see, potentially, I mean, this isn't happening either. What we thought might happen from the oil price being lower is the more expensive stuff in the Arctic, right, where it's tricky and cold and difficult to drill and we don't know how to do it, and some of the frontier fracking stuff. We thought some of that might not start. Why would you? Why would you spend a huge expensive project in the Arctic if you can just keep chugging out Saudi oil? But that's not happening either. You've got two entirely disconnected realities going on at the same time. You've got the one of global leaders like Obama last week saying climate change is hugely important. We have to leave oil in the ground. We have to do something about it. And the huge amount of international effort on climate change. On the other side, you've got trying to get literally as much oil as we possibly can out of the earth all at the same time and burn it in some sort of frenzy. And those two things do not sit together.
How does this relate to the global economy? And I mean, we've heard also already that the low price of oil is affecting the Russians. It's been difficult for them because they're committed internationally to selling oil and getting that money in. But how does these two subjects relate to each other? Global currency wars and energy prices.
Well, it's to do with elasticity of demand for oil, really. I mean, the thing...
That is one thing to interrupt you again, but there's one weird thing about all this is, actually, surely you just need to use the oil you need to use. If it's cheaper, it just means it's cheaper. It doesn't mean to say you're going to go running around in your car a few extra times around the ring road, David.
It does affect some decisions, though. If you know that the price... Say when you're buying a car, right? You will think about how much it's going to cost to run it. You'll think about what size engine you're going to get, right? And people do think about this stuff. And actually, one of the disastrous things that this government has done is remove some of the incentives to buy a greener car. But Martin used the word elasticity, which is your wonky economics term for basically as stuff gets cheaper, there is evidence that says people do use more of it. Okay, you're not going to just get up in the morning and say, I'm going to just do donuts in the car park and waste fuel for no reason. But you are probably going to think about, yeah, we will go for a trip to Weston this weekend. We will go that little bit further because it's that bit cheaper. People do think about it. It is a real thing.
Okay, also fracking. There's been some big changes, a bit of announcements over the last couple of weeks to do with the government's move to fast-track fracking planning. Now, this does seem a little bit like Dirty Tricks to me, where certain parts of the country have been saying no to fracking through the planning system, that there's been mass public and NGO and actually a lot of them at councils themselves saying we're not having this round here. The government are now saying, well, I tell you what, let's just scrap the planning process. What the hell's going on here, David?
Yeah, this is bang on, Tony. So fracking is hugely unpopular. The government's own studies say fewer than one in four people actively say they support fracking. A lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't like it, right? There are individual applications going on all over the country. You haven't been allowed to frack in this country since 2011, when there was earthquakes off the coast of Lancashire, right? So there's individual applications going in, and they keep getting rejected. So the most recent one was in Lancashire a couple of months ago, where Quadrilla, who are an arm of British Gas, a great big fracking company, wanted to go in and frack in an area in Lancashire. And the council considered it, deliberated on it, did a democratic process, democratically elected councillors like the one you had in here half an hour ago, and they said no thanks. By 9-3, they didn't want it. Hugely significant, they didn't want it because local people don't want fracking because of the risk of their groundwater, because of all the lorries, because of the visual impact, all of that sort of stuff.
Which is why it actually matters to vote for somebody, because they're sitting in there making that decision.
Yeah, and local, you know, it was great that you had your councillor on earlier. It does matter. Local decisions matter about things that you don't want to happen in your local area. You can get upset about it if your councillor doesn't do something you want them to do, but you vote them in, you vote them out. That's how it works, right? The government doesn't like this. The government doesn't like the idea that you give local planning authorities a say in whether or not to frack, and they're choosing not to frack, because this government, as we know, desperately wants to frack. It wants to frack under your house. It's changed the rules, so now fracking companies could theoretically frack under your house without you knowing about it. So what it's going to do, it's saying to all councils, you've got 16 weeks to approve any fracking application that comes your way, and if you're not approving it or you're delaying it, we're going to have a look at it, and chances are we'll probably override it. So basically, local decision making power on fracking is just being taken away, and I think it's an incredibly dangerous thing to do, because people really do not want it.
Why dangerous?
Well, so dangerous for two reasons. Firstly, because we will probably get loads of fracking, right? Which is firstly very bad in terms of climate change.
Are you talking about us here, the Mendips? I know there's been talk about it around here, hasn't there?
Yeah, and I think next week there's a thing called the 14th licensing round, right? Bit wonky. What it means is they're about to announce who has won licenses to explore for fracking all across the UK. And everywhere that is in the listenership of your programme is included. In fact, if you draw a square from Torquay down in the southwest all up to the Rhondda in Wales, go right across Oxford and down to Southampton, that square in its entirety has had companies bidding for it to frack. The Mendips is really hot for fracking. The people really want to frack there. It's one of the places in the firing line.
But hang on, that's where we get a lot of our water from.
Where we get a lot of our water from. There's one.
Drinking water, folks.
So 2,000. There's 2,000 aquifers in the UK, which the Environment Agency has said they're things called source protection zones. Basically, you shouldn't really mess around with them, right? And fracking will happen in a third of those if fracking happens in the way it looks like it's going to happen. You've got the Mendips and you've got the area around Bristol Airport, both of which are huge aquifers for Bristol and the Chew Valley and all that sort of area. So you could be looking at councillors in the Bristol area, in the Mendips, being asked to consider whether they want the risk of their groundwater being contaminated by fracking, which is, you know, incidentally, you have three different ways that fracking noises up your water. So it's the gas itself leaking into water. You'll have seen those videos from America of people setting their water supply on fire because the gas is in there, or the incredibly secretive toxic chemicals that are used to flush the gas out, or just the contamination of the process itself and the fact that you get out a whole load of sludge at the end of it. All of these things do contaminate water. In Pennsylvania, 10% 10% of all sites have been contaminated in that way. It is a thing. It happens. So you local councillors will say, no, thank you. We don't want that. We don't want that happening to our groundwater. Local people don't want it. They will reject it. The company will appeal. The councillors will consider it. They'll reject it. And then the government will come in with its size 10s and say, tough. You got to have it anyway. The second reason why it's dangerous is because people will not stand for that. And if I was the government, I wouldn't try to push through something that has proven to be as unpopular as fracking is.
And not just unpopular, but dangerous, Martin. This is seems to me like a kind of very much kind of almost dictatorial attitude by Westminster.
Well, it's the power of vested interest pulling strings behind the scenes, isn't it? I think the real problem, or one of the problems, is that the fracking industry in the US is leveraged to the hilt. They're absolutely dependent on money that they've borrowed, junk bonds, effectively, and they are.
It's a Ponzi scheme. It's a massive Ponzi scheme. The American.
Yeah, but once you're committed to these things, as I said earlier, you can't do the rational thing and withdraw because you've already committed yourself. So that's everybody, whether it's the Saudis, the frackers, the Russians, whoever. And we were talking about the Arctic earlier. Now, if there is any oil in the Arctic, the Russian military will want to have control of it, and similarly for the NATO nations. So you've got a military imperative to go in and get it to stop the other side from getting it, added to all of the economic pressures to just try and get the money back that we've already sunk.
But how does this relate to what's going on with fracking? Because we heard earlier on about the falling oil prices, energy prices generally. Surely the kind of calculations that were made a year ago about whether fracking is viable, they need to be looked at again with the energy price much lower now.
Well, so you've got two different sorts of fracking for a start. You've got fracking for oil, which happens a lot in the States. What we're really talking about in the UK is fracking for gas, which is, of course, different. So oil runs your car. Gas makes your electricity. So for although the oil price and the gas price are linked, it's not quite the same consideration. But the Martin's absolutely right, though. I mean, people are looking at gas under the ground, oil under the ground in the UK, in the Mendips. They're seeing pound signs in front of their eyes. They're going to drill, and they're hoping that what they get out will make them money. But it's still money for old rope. I mean, basically, the sheer incentive to go and drill it is colossal. Out there, absolutely colossal. What's interesting is that the thing that makes it the thing that affects the economics the most is how long it takes to get it through planning, because that introduces the risk, and that's the reason why the government are really trying to clamp down on what they call delays, what we call legitimate democratic process.
I do wonder if this is the wisest thing to do, Martin, because I mean, you're effectively doing with something like somewhere like the Mendips. I mean, I know also in North Yorkshire, places like Durham, you've got whole entire counties that are dead against this, and Westminster's now saying, right, we're going to do it anyway.
Well, yes, and if the government gets associated with that, it might cost them some elections. One would hope so. I think that what we really need is, you know, with all commodities, not just with oil, we need the suppliers need a stable environment, and so do the consumers. And we need to actually set up a situation where, well, what is the rational price for us all to have, which allows the suppliers to have security, and also that the consumers will know the security. And, you know, we used to talk about doing these things in the 1970s, but the world is too fractious now. I mean, oil has become part, and oil and currency are part of the geopolitical contest that's going on. And, interestingly enough, though, I think the Saudis are starting to talk to the Russians about the possibility of putting the price back up because they're hurting so much. They thought that the fracking industry in the US would crumble quickly and that the Russians would crumble quickly. Mm-hmm. But they can't afford to crumble. Nobody can afford to back down. It's like a game of chicken.
Also, how does this, I mean, probably doesn't affect it at all, but what's the latest on Hinkley? Because they've spent millions there, haven't they, already, yep, doing groundworks for a second nuclear power station. We're having these kind of currency wars going on with the Chinese, who are supposedly going to be backing it financially. What's the latest on whether that project's actually going to go ahead or not, David?
So there are links, but most of the things that is affecting Hinkley are just to do with the fact that the economics of Hinkley are rubbish, right? So the original cost to Hinkley was something like £25 billion. That keeps on rising. Estimates are up at about £35 to £50 billion now, huge amounts of which are going to be met by bill payers. So there's that. Two really significant things happened just in the last week that make you realise this isn't just a bunch of fringe people saying this is a bad idea. The HSBC and the Telegraph both came out and said, hang on a minute, maybe we should consider not building this thing, right? The Telegraph, this is the Telegraph, right? As right-wing, as establishment as you can get, came out and said, isn't this thing going to take a massive amount of time to build and cost a huge amount of money? Austria is taking the UK to court in Brussels because we're doling out such a huge amount of money to something that they think is technologically and environmentally unjustifiable. And the technology itself that they're planning on using packed in and failed in a Finnish reactor a couple of years ago. So every way you look at this project, it's getting more and more risky and more expensive. Meanwhile, the costs of other ways of generating energy, solar and renewables, other renewables and things like that, keeps on falling. So I wouldn't put money into that. And it's interesting that HSBC are saying maybe it's not a good idea too as well.
Any good news on the environment?
Not in the last couple of months. No, not in the UK anyway. So I could sit here and reel off the list.
But I mean,
this
is an atmosphere that kind of swirls around the world. So where's good? Where's the air good?
So I'll tell you, an interesting thing is over in the States, actually. I'll tell you what's interesting about this is you've got two real polar extremes of environmental stuff going on at the same time, playing out writ large. You have got Barack Obama, who is genuinely, I think, trying to use his last few months in office to do something decent on climate change, saying good stuff, trying to drag this coal-addicted nation into the 21st century. And then you've got Donald Trump, who is, you know, one of the front runners for the Republicans, complete joke, standing up there and saying with a straight face and getting plaudits for it that climate change is made up by the Chinese in order to make US manufacturing uncompetitive. And these things are, and on both sides, there's a real splintering going on. So your Democrats are flocking to Obama, some of the Republicans, not all, thankfully, are flocking to Trump. It's a really interesting debate. Over here, we're just getting more and more stepping back from this. But you remember the idea that the Conservatives were the greenest government ever. You might remember that. That has all gone. The amount of I'm not going to reel it off. The amount of stuff that's been scrapped just in the first two months of this government is terrifying.
Well, just give us an idea of the sort of stuff that's been scrapped.
Because,
I mean, I didn't realise so much had been. I mean, I thought they were slowly changing things. And obviously, with the previous government in 2010, there was quite a lot of reduction in things like environmental subsidies for solar, that kind of thing. So what are the big headlines about what's changed since May?
Okay, let's have... next week or the week after, we are expecting big announcements on slashing, like really cutting the amount of subsidy you get for putting solar panels on your roofs, to the extent that it is probably going to make a lot of things not happen. You've got that. You've got the ban on onshore wind. They promised to do it in their manifesto. They hate onshore wind turbines. They promised to do it. They have effectively banned it. There's a thing called the Green Investment Bank, which is a state bank set up specifically because the private sector doesn't want to invest in renewables, which they are privatising. There used to be tax bans to incentivise you to buy greener cars. There basically aren't going to be any more, so it's going to be as the tax will be the same on running a Porsche as a Prius. There used to be requirements on developers to build low carbon homes. They've all gone. What else you got? Oh yeah, and the best one of all. So there used to be a carbon tax, which obviously was paid by coal and gas and other sorts of fossil fuels, and now George Osborne is going to make renewable energy pay that as well. I'm not making it up. Renewable energy is paying a carbon tax. It's pretty extraordinary.
It is, isn't it? I mean, last time I saw it, the guy looks like a heroin addict, George Osborne. He's gone completely pasty white. He seems to get made up for TV all the time, and I do wonder about the wisdom of some of his decisions. Martin, this government does seem to have taken on the environmental lobby full steam ahead. The idea really being that, again, we're going back to the old days of oil.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a kind of, there's an element of triumphalism, isn't it? You can see that the right wing of the Tory party now feel that they are off the leash. They've got 5 years, a majority of 12, no Liberal Democrats whinging in the corner, off we go. But whether this is actually going to be popular in the long run, things like fracking is actually going to undermine their support in their core areas. And they really need
David,
to think about
what are
that.
Friends of the Earth, if anything, able to do about this?
Oh, loads of stuff. So go to our website, www.foe.co.uk, and find out more, or give us a call, 0207 490 1555. What we are doing is we are going where the fight is. We were up in Lancashire. We were helping raise protests against fracking. We were in Wales the other day where there was a rejection of a plan for an open cast coal mine. We're taking the fight to government. We're going to be working with whoever the next Labour leadership is, try and get them to grow a pair on this stuff. We're getting loads and loads of stuff.
David Powell, Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us again on The Politics Show.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Back to China now, Martin. This explosion this week, a blast in the Chinese port of Tianjin. I'm a bit suspicious about this, mainly because we haven't had an accident like this in China for decades, and it comes on the same week as we've had these not opening shots but continuing in a way in the sort of economic competition, the economic warfare that's going on between East and West.
Well, we don't know enough about it to say that it is definitely part of a a sabotage action. But there are certain elements within the Chinese state who do believe that the West is capable of carrying out sabotage actions inside China. And given that we what we know about the way some Western intelligence services work, it wouldn't be entirely beyond belief that they would try to sabotage Chinese infrastructure.
What about the MH17? Because I know there's been a lot of... This is the airliner, Malaysian airliner, that came down in... was brought down in east of Ukraine, possibly by the rebels, possibly by the Ukrainians, possibly by the Russians. There's a whole... this whole thing seems to have been kicked into touch. But one thing's for sure, that there was a lot of... one of the key bits of evidence in this, which is the pilot, the guy whose name was Wan Hussein, Hussin, his final name. The pilot's body, even his family have not seen an autopsy of it or anything. The agreements were made with the Malaysian government that certain aspects of this were going to be kept secret. Why is that? And why are the Malaysians themselves, the Malaysian government, not in charge of this investigation, since it's their aircraft and their passengers and their responsibility and Malaysian credibility at stake here?
Well, the fact that normal procedure hasn't been pursued is in itself a red light, isn't it? It's a clear indication that there's something suspicious gone on here. Why hasn't normal procedure been pursued? And the answer is, quite possibly, it's quite possible that this plane was shot down by accident, either by the rebels or by the Kiev regime. But it's also quite possible that one or the other side, and the only side that has a motive is the Kiev regime side working with the Western intelligence services, has a motive for shooting down the plane. And the evidence, the Russian general staff have already given a press conference. They gave a press conference a few weeks after the incident, showing everything they'd got, their satellite pictures, and their satellite pictures clearly showed fighter planes from Kiev in the vicinity of the plane that went down. Which the Kiev regime denied, but the facts were there, and the Americans, of course, have got satellite imagery of the whole thing, which they haven't shown us. Why not? It's probably because it doesn't show what they want us to think. Most ordinary people still think that it was, as the Sun said, Putin's missile, but the facts don't suggest so.
Britain to double the number of... Well, it's interesting, of course, that the Sun said that before anyone knew anything that was going on.
Indeed.
So how did they know? Britain to double the number of Ukrainian troops, its training, as Russian-backed separatists launched the biggest assault in 6 months. This is Kim Sengupta in The Independent this week. Britain will double the number of Ukrainian troops, its training. It's been announced as Russian-backed separatists have launched their biggest assault in 6 months against government forces. Defence Secretary Michael Fallon declared the move was imperative. The violence in the east of the country, orchestrated by Vladimir Putin, shows no sign of ending anytime soon. Russia-inspired terrorism, he maintains, has ensured the conflict was certainly not frozen, but one which is red hot, with Ukraine's borders under threat. So I assume more troops, more training, certainly of the Ukrainians, going on by the British Army.
Well, thousands... nobody's quite sure, but thousands of civilians have died in the two independent republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, killed by indiscriminate shelling by the Ukrainian National Army. And Amnesty International and others have pointed out that lots of people have been tortured to death by particularly by the so-called independent battalions, Pravi Sector and the Azov Battalion. You know, you've basically got private armies there run by neo-Nazis who have been engaging in war crimes.
Well, I noticed the neo-Nazi summer camps have started in Ukraine. So Ukrainian children are being taught to shoot AK-47s by Azov Battalion members. Who is the Azov Battalion?
The Azov Battalion is one of these volunteer outfits. And the problem is the Ukrainian army is a conscript army, and many of them don't want to fight for obvious reasons. So they get into indiscriminate shelling and hiding in their bunkers. And then you've got these extremists who are dead keen on killing people, and but they're not actually that good at fighting.
Well, they sound actually,
they've been run out of both republics by the
locals. They sound
locals,
like sort of paramilitary forces rather than...
Well, they are paramilitary forces. And if the British get involved in this, then we are involved in it. And in actual fact, these forces have killed thousands of civilians.
Sounds to me
which
like...
Which means that we, the British, are responsible.
Sounds to me like...
For supporting people who kill thousands of civilians.
Sounds to me like the British or the Ukrainians are actually already part of NATO, even though they haven't officially signed up. We don't want to be a mere buffer zone. The new Polish president calls for more NATO troops. Andrzej Duda, new Polish president, has called on NATO countries to deploy more troops as well as create new permanent military bases in his country and other Central European countries, saying Poland does not want to be a buffer zone anymore. He wants to be the sort of hard end of NATO, the front line now.
Well, I think I'm used to live in Poland. I think this and on the eastern border as well. This is idiotic from the Polish regime. They need, in fact, to be. They should, in fact, be mediators between the West.
But you can see
East,
what's
the Ukrainian
on.
Government.
But Martin,
was.
You can see what's going on here. This is a former colony, effectively, of the Russians. Nobody likes people that used to rule them in the past.
No, they don't. But at the same time, you can still have friendly relations with them, as we do with many former colonies of the British Empire. And the Polish economy is being ruined by the sanctions which have been imposed by the Americans on the Russians. But of course, it's the Poles who actually have to do all of the sanctions. And in Lithuania and Poland, you've got extreme right-wing politicians calling for sanctions on Russia. And guess what, folks? They're then turning around saying, we have lost billions of dollars because of these sanctions, and we want you in Britain to compensate us for our decision not to trade with the Russians, because we're all in this together.
On now to look at 9/11. The anniversary is coming up soon, and this is a talk which was done earlier this year by Christopher Bolle, and I worked with Christopher over in, I think it was in Jeanval in 2000, covering the Bilderberg Conference. He and I and about one other journalist there. But here he is. He's got quite a lot to say about the history of the terrorist activities by the Israeli state. And he starts by looking at Israeli terrorism against the British.
This is the handiwork of the first man, Menachem Begin. In 1946, Menachem Begin, along with David Ben-Gurion of the Haganah, and members of the Jewish Agency, bombed the King David Hotel, which was a luxury hotel in Jerusalem, which also happened to be headquarters of the British Mandate. The British military forces, their headquarters were in there. Now, there's a similarity with 9/11, because the British had conducted an operation called Operation Black Sabbath, when they had gone throughout Palestine and arrested a lot of these terror leaders, and they had collected a lot of evidence. And the evidence indicated that the Jewish Agency was involved in the terrorism in Palestine. That's a very big piece of information. Well, that led to why did they bomb this? You know, conventional wisdom is that they bombed this to kick the British out of Palestine. No, they bombed this because the evidence of the Zionist crimes was in this building. And by destroying the building, you destroyed the evidence. Very similar to what happened on 9/11. Because that building 6 I showed you, that held the evidence of crimes like Enron, gold scandals, huge crimes that were being prosecuted. But when the evidence was destroyed, as in Building 6, the vault that was below Building 6 was the vault for Building 6 and Building 7, U.S. Customs House and that whole Building 7. All the evidence and gold was in that vault. But what they found, what Kurt Sonnenfeld found, the videographer from the FEMA, he found that when he got down to the basement of Building 6, that the vault had been cleaned out the night before. Which is why you have this incredible explosion. Somebody either sent a missile into that building or put a shaped charge in the basement of that building and blew it up in an attempt to destroy the evidence that they had stole, that they had robbed the vault the night before. This is the murder of Volker Bernadotte in September 18th, 1948. This was done, as I said, by Yitzhak Shamir, the Stern Gang, also known as Lehi, the Stern Gang. And this was the UN mediator who was sent to Palestine to try and make a livable operation out of the partition plan of Palestine. They partitioned Palestine between Jewish and Palestinian sections, hoping that there would be some peace in the country. And he wanted to implement, he knew that it wasn't going to work, but he also said that they have to have, Jerusalem has to be an independent, separate, free state, open to all. And this is the handiwork of Ariel Sharon, the third man in that picture. This is the massacre of the Palestinians in Sabra and Shatila in 1982, in which Palestinian camps in West Beirut were, the inhabitants were massacred, thousands of people were massacred, while the Israeli army secured the area around it and provided flares so they could go on with the massacre for nighttime. Went on for like 2 or 3 days. And anybody who tried to get out of the camps was then shot by the Israelis as they tried to leave. This is the man who was found responsible by Israel. The Kahan Commission found him responsible. He lost his portfolio. He lost his position in the Israeli cabinet. He was told that he was unfit to have any leadership positions in the Israeli government. And then in 2001, he got elected as prime minister. And I called my sister, who's Jewish, and told her that this is a very bad constellation. Here we have George Bush, stole the election or whatever. He got elected by the Supreme Court. And this man was in power in Israel. And I said, this is exactly like we had in 1982. And we had Ronald Reagan, who was like a born-again Christian Zionist, along with Menachem Begin. So you had a terrorist leader in Israel, in our ally, with an ideologically committed person in the Republican Party. And it led to the war in Lebanon in 1982. It led to Ronald Reagan sending troops to try and hold the line.
And Chris Bull in there, and I'll put a link to that on our show page, www.thisweek.org.uk. A full El Al flight took off on 9/11 from JFK to Tel Aviv, even though all flights were grounded. Time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7. The Mohammed Makawi is on after Bristol this. His last show, I think. And I'm off to do some World War II research in Hailing Island next week. So no show next week. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time. And don't let the banksters get you down. Like I say, show page thisweek.org.uk.
National news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Kensington Palace says the international paparazzi's pursuit of Prince George has become a security risk. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have written a strongly worded letter to photographers, accusing them of going to increasingly extreme lengths to get pictures of the two-year-old and his sister Charlotte. French journalist Benedict Paviot says the appetite for pictures abroad is different when it comes to the royals.
The British royal family, let's remember, across the pond in America, in a lot of other countries in the world, are admired, are respected, but they are also viewed with less respect often. They're seen as celebrities.
A coroner in